because mainstream media's coverage is not balanced and reliable. It's expensive for KPFK to continue our fair and equal coverage, which includes broadcasting the voices of people on the ground and those speaking truth to power. If you value reliable, unfiltered news coverage, support your independent radio station today by calling 818-985-5735. Hit option 2. Any amount helps. Pledge online at kpfk.org.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, and welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm co-host Jim Lafferty, along with my friend and co-host Maria Hall, welcoming you to this week's edition of the show. Maria, let our listeners know what they're in for if they stay tuned, and I hope they do.
Yes, Jim, I think from now on, every single episode that we play here is going to be more important than ever. And today we're focusing on school, the Department of Education, DEI. And, you know, it's a full-time job to keep up with this, all of the you-know-what coming out of the White House. So we're so lucky that we have the person who always does his homework, and he does it for us. So we are so grateful to Stephen Rohde, who is going to answer a lot of the questions on our mind and let us know what's going on in the world.
It is also a fun drive here at KPFK, but I remind our listeners, hey, don't switch the dial. We only spend a very few minutes of every hour pitching for your support, for your renewed membership, for your first-time membership, if that's the case. I mean, really, it's a matter of maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes for the whole show, here and there a minute or two. So we don't interrupt the substance of the show much at all anymore. We do that, of course, depending on you to respect that, and to therefore make those phone calls without us railing at you for 20 or 30 minutes of every hour. All right, so let's get started with today's topic as you begin to think about that, my friends. Donald Trump has launched his second term as president, of course, and he's launched it with an avalanche of executive orders as part of a, well, a calculated shock and awe strategy designed to take over the federal government in defiance of the Constitution, of Congress, and maybe even the Supreme Court. One of the most dangerous aspects of that scheme is his plan to dismantle well-established programs and policies that encourage diversity, equity, and inclusion, known as DEI, in American society in general, and in education in particular. He wants to ban the teaching of critical race theory and to either totally eliminate the Department of Education or, at a minimum, strip it of its key functions and funding. The Department of Education, of course, was established by an act of Congress in 1979, signed by President Jimmy Carter into law. The Department of Ed says its elementary and secondary programs today serve more than 50 million students in about 98,000 public schools and 32,000 private schools. It also provides grants, loans, and work-study assistance to more than 12 million post-secondary students. Well, according to Becky Pringle, the president of the National Education Association, Trump's expected executive order to abolish the Department of Ed, if it becomes a reality, quote, would steal resources from the most vulnerable students, explode class sizes, cut job training programs, make higher ed more expensive and out of reach for middle-class families, take away special education services for students with disabilities, and gut student civil rights protections, close quote. A bill has been introduced in the House of Representatives already to eliminate the Department of Education, though since it would require 60 votes in the U.S. Senate, it is perhaps unlikely to pass. Christopher Rufo, a senior fellow at the Conservative Manhattan Institute, writing in its publication City Journal, spells out rather clearly why the right is so determined to shut the department down. After pointing out the areas of its work, Rufo says it engages in, quote, ideological production which includes an array of programs, grants, and civil rights initiatives, and third-party NGOs that create left-wing content to push on local schools, close quote. Indeed, he refers to the Department of Education overall as, and I quote, a hotbed of left-wing ideologies. Well, last Friday, the department did sent all schools a letter warning them of a loss of federal funding if they so much as give a nod to the matter of race in matters of hiring decisions or, well, any other aspect of student, academic, and campus life. And so today we spend our entire hour looking at the legality of Trump's plans to target DEI, critical race theory, and the Department of Ed itself. And if he is successful, what will be lost? And what is it likely to mean for the state of education in America? And as Maria Hall has already said, we're joined today by our go-to guest, Constitutional Legal Matters, Mr. Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a civil rights activist, author, and constitutional scholar. He practiced civil rights law for almost 50 years. He currently serves as chair of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, which was formed in the wake of 9/11 for the purpose of organizing, you know, faith-based communities and to call for an end to war and violence. Mr. Rohde is also a past president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California. He's a past chair of Death Penalty Focus in California and of Bend the Arc, a Jewish Partnership for Justice. Now, despite, I should mention, that long list of affiliations, today Mr. Rohde is speaking not on their behalf, but only on behalf of himself. Steve Rohde, a welcome, a warm one, back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Maria. It is so good to be with you and to be able to dig deep into these really dangerous new executive orders that President Trump is issuing.
Oh, boy. Yes, indeed. Well, and before we get to what is the main subject today of all of that, I do want to point out and ask you a question, because Trump's intention to get rid of the Federal Department of Education and many of its current functions, what we're going to be talking about. But we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you to comment on the first test of Trump's power to fire government officials that has reached actually the Supreme Court this week. It involves the firing of Hamilton Dellinger, who was the head of the Office of Special Counsel. But talk to us briefly, Steve, about this case and the Supreme Court precedent it could well overturn.
Well, literally, as we broadcast this episode of the Lawyers Guild Show, the U.S. Supreme Court is considering a petition from the Trump Department of Justice in this important case. Literally, as we speak, orders may be issued by the Supreme Court. And I think it's very important for us and listeners to understand what's at stake. Hamilton Dellinger was appointed by the Biden administration, but he was confirmed by the Senate in 2024 by a bipartisan vote, and he was given a five-year term to serve as head of the Office of Special Counsel. That means his term by law and by Congress continues until 2029. His is a very important office. He guards federal workers from illegal personnel actions, such as retaliation for whistleblowing. I think it's beyond ironic that the inspector counsel, the special counsel, who is to protect federal workers from illegal personnel actions, is himself been fired by the President of the United States. The problem is that the statute that created his position makes very clear that he may not be removed and may only be removed by the President only for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. And the notice he received last week specified none of those. It simply fired him. So Mr. Dellinger went to court. He won a district court ruling temporarily reinstating him. It was that persuasive, the case made right at the threshold, that he was reinstated while the case itself goes forward to be fully briefed and argued. And then the Federal Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, upheld the reinstatement, and that teed the case up for the Supreme Court, which is considering the briefing as we speak. It's going to be an early case that will test a lot of the challenges to Trump's executive orders that we'll be talking about today. And it will be a test of what is called the unified executive theory, which we'll expand on throughout this program. This is a theory that places the President of the United States at the head of the executive branch, that puts him in the most powerful position. And some proponents of the unified executive theory believe it means that Congress plays no role in restricting or imposing any limitations on the president's power. That's what's at stake here. And I am sure that listeners will watch for any decisions in that case as they emerge.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that. Now, getting to the essence of our program today, having to do with the Department of Education and education in general in America, I suppose the first question, obviously, Steve, is when Trump issues that executive order, as he's expected to do shortly, does he have the authority, the power to actually shut down the Department of Education by executive order, which, as I pointed out earlier, was established by an act of Congress?
The simple, straightforward answer is no. And I hope that's how the courts, all the way up to the Supreme Court, handle this. I think it's worth, we have some time today, and it's important that the foundational concepts be understood in terms of our Constitution, because what Trump is doing is a frontal assault on the very structure of the Constitution, which has three branches. The legislative, which, by the way, is the first branch mentioned. The founders made a lot of mistakes, but they also made some wise decisions, and they put the legislature at the top of the government. The legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. Let's not forget that it is Congress that makes the laws and that appropriates the money to implement those laws. The president's powers are clearly stated in the Constitution. The very first section of Article 1 says the executive power shall be vested in the president of the United States of America. But the Constitution doesn't stop there. Section 3 of Article 1 says, it almost catches in my craw to use the male pronoun throughout the U.S. Constitution, but we live with that until someone has the brilliance to amend the entire Constitution to remove the male pronoun. But for now, it reads, "He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed." We really have to pause there. I mean, will these originalists on the Supreme Court who rely on the text, the precise text of the Constitution, will they look and clearly see that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed? And where do the laws get passed in our country? In Congress. So that's powerful. And it's worth mentioning that the oath of office of the president is stated in the Constitution. And the oath is that I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So I think those powers are clear. He cannot abolish by the strike of a magic marker his the Department of Education. If he wants to take it on, and as you mentioned, a bill has been introduced, it is going to be a huge debate in Congress, both the House and the Senate, whether this department will be abolished for all of the positive roles that it plays. So that's my safe prediction, that you cannot, the president, by one of these executive orders, cannot abolish the Department of Education.
Well, Steve Rohde, even if Trump can't directly do it in the way that you described, can't we expect that he'll be taking some indirect aim at the Department of Education in order to get to the same end? And if so, what do you think the constitutional issues are with that alternative plan?
Yes, it's interesting that it's been a couple of weeks. Jim said, there was an avalanche of executive orders. But as we record and broadcast this program, he has not issued an executive order abolishing the Department of Education. I actually predict that he may not. He may not issue a frontal assault because what I've already explained is so clear. And I know that the president and his advisors listen to the Lawyers Guild show each Wednesday. And it's clear by now in this program that he does not have the power. Instead, I think what we'll see is a whittling away, a strangulation of the Department of Education under the theory that as he now has Elon Musk rampaging through all of government, he'll have him rampage through the Department of Education. We already know from various public statements that Trump wants to transfer some of the duties of the Department of Education either to other U.S. Federal departments or down to the individual states. What's behind that is then these fragile sections of the Department of Education would be spread out. New regulations could be implemented by the different departments to which he sends these powers. And even more dangerously, and I think we'll explore this a little more later, sending it back to the states will create a crazy quilt of 50 different standards of education and implementation. He also wants to legalize school vouchers to allow parents to send their children to private and religious schools. I believe this is a key thing that's underlying a lot of what he's doing. He wants to withhold funds from schools that use curriculum that's focused on race and ethnicity and the protection of transgender students. That's in the area of DEI we'll be talking about. And he wants to overhaul prohibitions on the discrimination based on gender. He wants the states and local school boards to be the arbiters of what is taught in school and what happens with many of those functions. Now, specifically from a legal and constitutional standpoint, he's going to confront what is called the Impoundment Act. Congress, fearful that they would allocate and appropriate funds, might face an executive who would not spend those funds in the way that Congress had specified. So there is a congressional act that when money is appropriated, it must be spent by the president. He cannot frustrate the acts of Congress, which he cannot directly abolish, by starving those programs and not spending the money as Congress has allocated. And the Impoundment Act says exactly that. So he's going to have to confront the Impoundment Act. But to give you a preview, if he pursues the unified executive theory, I anticipate that his new Department of Justice will claim that the Impoundment Act is itself unconstitutional, that is an impingement on his absolute powers. This would be a catastrophic attack on the separation of powers. The Impoundment Act has been used and upheld for decades, and he would be teeing up a major constitutional crisis if he goes after the Impoundment Act itself.
Well, just before I ask my next question, though, something you said I'm wondering about. To the extent that he in a sense, stops the Department of Education from doing certain aspects of what they do under the law, hasn't he right there run into the same problem? I mean, by taking them away from the department, he's legislated, has he not?
Yes, exactly. The Congress chooses what departments to create,
right,
what powers to give them. And under the delegation theory, delegates to those departments then the micromanaging and the expertise to implement those. It simply is not up. It would be up to a monarch. It would be up to a king to do everything he's suggesting. But in a constitutional democracy, it is not up to him to parse out and redistribute the authorities and powers that Congress has specified.
All right. Well, among all the havoc Trump is wrecking since he returned to the White House, what is he trying to achieve, do you think, with the various executive orders he's issued dealing with diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, the DEI, and the banning of critical race theory and his threats to the Department of Education itself? What's the overall goal there?
Yeah, I thought along a lot about this, and I really believe this is part of a long-term goal. It goes back even before Trump. It's embedded in the Republican Party. I think it's a goal to close the minds of American students, to really suppress the teaching of a comprehensive, accurate American history, and frankly, to reimpose a white nationalist, patriarchal regime throughout the country. That's what Make America Great Again means. That's what he wants to turn the clock back, because then he and frankly, white men like him would control all three branches of government. They would be able to indoctrinate students without a comprehensive, broad, critical examination of American history. They would be able to implicate a single theory of American, a triumphal American exceptionalism. So these come in many different executive orders and policy statements, and then the implementation of them by underlings. But I think it has within it that overall plan. Let's be sure at the outset to recognize that DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and its expanded terms, is a success story in overcoming much of the sexism and racism in the United States. But we have hardly reached a colorblind society, even though Chief Justice John Roberts crows in his when he was nominated, and even in his decisions, that now we have a colorblind society. So why do we need affirmative action, and why do we need these programs? Well, look at any of the statistics on the earnings of women compared to men, on housing discrimination, on discrimination in employment, in healthcare, etc. Sadly, we have not reached that colorblind society. So there are legal DEI programs to try to combat the kind of systemic discrimination this country has suffered under for centuries. There are scholarships aiding underrepresented racial minorities. There's culturally themed dorms at colleges that have been upheld. There are even optional graduation ceremonies. One professor of education at USC explained that the Supreme Court did not outlaw race-conscious campus programs or resources. Now, there was the Harvard case decided a few years ago and said that in admissions and in hiring, you could not give preference and you could not even take into consideration race or gender. But those cases have been limited to admissions and hiring. The U.S. Supreme Court has not yet struck down the kinds of affirmative action and DEI programs that we've been talking about today. Now, that remains to be seen. And I think part of what Trump is doing is teeing up the most extreme theory to combat DEI, and he wants to give those six conservative members of the Supreme Court a chance to expand on their earlier rulings. So we're not out of the woods yet, but before we go on, I just want to explain to the audience that Trump issued a series of executive orders. That's what we're talking about today, and I just want to identify a few of them so it's understood what we're discussing. Right off the bat, January 20 in the afternoon that he was sworn in, and the next day, the 21st, he issued an executive order ending radical and wasteful government DEI programs and preferences. Then he issued the second one, ending illegal discrimination and restoring merit-based opportunities. Those were the two key ones he issued. A week later, on January 29, he issued two more executive orders directing federal agencies to determine how to expand school choice, which we'll talk about, and develop a strategy to end what he considers radical indoctrination in schools. And we'll expand on that. But those are the orders we're facing.
Oh, yeah. So that is a lot. And I'm just chuckling because, you know, I'm a child of the Generation X, and we had a lot of the a lot of that. And I turned out OK. Right.
So far, we got
so far. Well, what I wanted to ask, sorry, back to the show, Stephen Rohde, are those executive orders legal? I know that's a loaded question, but what constitutional issues do they raise?
I think we're going to see a range of rulings on this. Fortunately, and I take encouragement by the robust civic society that has been built up over many years. There are something like 70 lawsuits that have been filed since January 20. They've been filed by state attorneys general. They've been filed by organizations, and we'll talk about two lawsuits in a moment by the ACLU and others. So there are smart lawyers on our side. There are smart lawyers on the side of the Constitution and the precedents that have been established. So as much havoc as Trump is causing, real smart lawyers are going up against him. Already preliminary injunctions have been issued. And they are based on the fact, and by now we know our material today, that he cannot usurp Congress. He must faithfully execute the laws. And a third principle that doesn't get enough attention, in my view, is a doctrine of unconstitutional conditions. This is a well-established theory by now that you cannot, when you give federal money out, condition it on either discriminatory terms or on terms that violate other aspects of the Constitution, such as the First Amendment or separation of church and state. You cannot coerce people for the taking of money that they dearly need in education and elsewhere to give up those fundamental constitutional rights. So I think that there's going to be a very clear development of the law. And briefly, I want to mention two lawsuits, because too much in my own family, friends, and the circles I travel in, is a level of despair, a level of hopelessness. that this is too huge, that we cannot fight this behemoth. And I think these lawsuits that are being framed are very important because, and we'll talk about that we need to go beyond lawsuits. But on February 3rd, the National Association of Diversity Officers in Higher Education, the American Association of University Professors, the Restaurant Opportunities Center United, and the Mayor and City Council of Baltimore, Maryland, sued the Trump administration, taking head on those DEI executive orders I mentioned a moment ago. They've alleged that not only does he lack the authority to issue these grants because of the separation of powers, but that they violate the First and Fifth Amendments to the United States Constitution, especially in this area of education. The First Amendment protects academic freedom. It protects students and teachers at all levels of education. And clearly what Trump is doing is putting his thumb on one side in these content-based executive orders. And it's very key that these cases are going up against that. He's also violating due process. These executive orders are written by really ill-equipped policymakers. Maybe a few lawyers had a hand in this. If you read them, they are vague. They're filled with polemical language and rhetoric rather than legal terms. And vague laws, especially in the area of the First Amendment, are unconstitutional. But I was proud of this first lawsuit because it began quoting one of the most famous statements in support of the First Amendment in Supreme Court history. Quote, "If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein." That was written in 1943 in an important case, West Virginia versus Barnett. And for their own words, the plaintiffs begin by saying this, and I think what I'm going to read you in a few sentences, this is a template that should be understood in every one of these lawsuits. Quote, "In the United States, there is no king. The president can exercise only those powers the Constitution grants to the executive, and only in ways that do not violate the rights of the Constitution, which grants to the American people. In his crusade to erase diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility from our country, President Trump cannot usurp Congress's exclusive power or of the purse, nor can he silence those who disagree with him by threatening them with the loss of federal funds and other enforcement actions." And let me quickly say, because we are a topical radio show, that a few hours ago, another lawsuit was filed in this area. It was brought by the National Urban League, the National Fair Housing Alliance, and the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. It was filed in Washington, D.C. It is a 101-page complaint outlining how Donald Trump's orders not only undermine these organizations' mission, but threatens their very existence should they be forced to comply. It elaborates on some of the very legal doctrines I've already mentioned in terms of the first lawsuit. It's brought by a group of powerful organizations, and I think we're going to have to monitor that case as it moves along in the courts.
I think we better also, take a brief station ID break, because I think we've already run over a couple of minutes when we're supposed to do that. No harm done, but we'll stop now. We'll have a brief station ID break, and then we'll be right back with you here on the Lawyers Guild Show.
This is Ed Beck. and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org.
Get up, stand up. And we are back with you. You're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall, and our guest today, Steve Rohde. We're talking about executive orders by the president. We're particularly looking at what he's trying to do with national education, with the National Education Department, and with education as taught in the classroom. Let me just jump ahead a little bit. Steve, you mentioned that Trump has issued an executive order directing the Department of Education to expand school choice programs using federal money, taxpayer dollars. We know Trump also claims he wants to include attendance at religious schools in that school choice, as well as private schools. Does this not raise legal constitutional questions, especially as it pertains to giving federal tax dollars to religious schools? What happened to separation of church and state?
Well, that's the term, Jim. And this one is an example of saying the quiet part out loud. The Republican Party, conservatives, and once Trump led the MAGA wing of those parties, which now fully dominates, it has always been about Christian nationalism. It has always been about turning the United States of America into a Christian nation, which they believe it was from the founding, because they ignore history, they ignore the First Amendment. Again, these are these originalists that should be paying attention to those fundamental principles. The First Amendment of the Constitution makes it very clear, and it was revolutionary in this sense compared to European governments and monarchies, that there is a separation of church and state. Jefferson and Madison were very concerned, even specifically about spending public money on religion, that they wanted to keep government out of religion and religion out of government. And largely those principles have been upheld in a series of U.S. Supreme Court decisions. What Trump is doing here as another sop to his base is to elevate school choice. Now, that's one time he's being euphemistic, because school choice is to recircuit public money, our taxpayer money, into parochial and private schools. And it's a direct violation of separation of church and state. There have been some nuances in the Supreme Court, but none that would allow this particular executive order to be upheld. So I see it as a frontal attack on that. I think many of these executive orders are meant to let the six-member Supreme Court have its way. If they can get five votes for any one of these propositions, then we're even in deeper trouble than we are now.
Well, Steve Rohde, beyond getting rid of the Department of Education itself, Trump wants to cut funding for any schools or programs pushing quote-unquote critical race theory. And of course, that opens civil rights investigations into schools discriminating against certain ethnic students and to recruit teachers using a program that roots out so-called radical teachers and then replaces them with more patriotic teachers. He also wants to engage in finding and removing radicals from national education programs who have infiltrated the federal Department of Education. What's your reaction to all of this? Are the legal issues raised, are they legal issues or more political questions?
Well, this is the renewal of efforts that Trump pursued in his first term in office. There he established the 1776 Commission to impose his singular version of American history on all students. And as much as they want to impose that approach, they want to displace the kind of teaching that has luckily gone on, at least in the recent past, because our textbooks historically were filled with racist material, sexist and homophobic material, and it's taken a long time to have our textbooks and our teaching materials reflect a more accurate picture of American history. Critical race theory, now that actually comes out of law school, and it was a high-level analysis to realize that race and racism infect virtually every institution in American life. And so law schools were able to take a deep look at that, and they called it critical race theory, that you must look at the institutions in America to determine the degree to which racism still infects those systems. Translating that into history, it's very similar to the 1619 Project that the New York Times published several years ago, which Trump went after. So in his 1776 project, he has now renewed all of that in his January 29 executive order, ending radical indoctrination in schools. You know, sometimes just reading the words of what our opponents say speaks for itself. He wants by federal order to, quote, instill a patriotic admiration of our incredible nation and the values for which we stand. He wants to eliminate radical anti-American ideologies from teaching. He wants to eliminate anti-American, subversive, harmful, and false ideologies. Can you imagine how any teacher is expected to implement this policy? What kinds of regulations the whatever is left of the Department of Education, or when it's delegated down to the individual states? This is hopeless. He wants to eradicate any teaching which makes an individual feel guilt, anguish, or other forms of psychological distress because of, or should be discriminated against, blamed, or stereotyped because of actions in the past. It's hopeless. He wants to instill virtues of merit, excellence, hard work, fairness, and neutrality, and racial colorblindedness. I mentioned it before. It's now in a federal executive order that we are to teach that today the society is colorblinded. So, and there's much more to this, but I want to summarize it by saying that I think all of these principles are vulnerable because they are so vague and they invade the First Amendment and academic freedom, which we'll talk about, in such a way that I do believe that there are some justices, even in the conservative wing, that will not be able to tolerate these principles.
Well, critics of Trump's plans around the federal government's role with regard to education, they're worried about what some cuts in federal funds under Title I will mean. So let's talk about that for a moment. Now, Title I money, federal money, is used by local schools to hire tutors, to hire counselors, to provide other services to students with mobile learning disabilities, for example. But Trump and the authors of Project 2025, where, by the way, many of his executive orders can be found to have originated in terms of the desire for same. But I say Trump and authors of Project 2025 believe that Title I and its functions themselves should be scrapped, not just the Department of Education, but that very important function and what it does for the schools and for learning in America, that should be scrapped. And this at a time, by the way, when our nation's schools are grappling with budgetary uncertainty due to an end of COVID-19 relief grants. Remember those that went out. If Trump succeeds, Stephen, in getting rid of the Department of Education, Can he also eliminate by executive order federal money being sent through any means on such seeming necessities? When it comes to this position, that is, of federal tax dollars, isn't that also a matter for Congress alone to decide?
Well, it is. And I'm so grateful that you would dig down into what these programs are. Sometimes we can speak on such a high level on some of the legal theories and the constitutional theories. We miss that real students, real people at every level of education will suffer as a result of these programs. People in his base will suffer. This is the self-inflicted wound that people were blinded by so much rhetoric in the Trump campaign. But I believe that as these cuts, well, as the proposal of the cuts sink in, that people will really see what Trump is up to. And of course, we haven't said it yet, it is entirely part of the plan to gut the government in the social and educational programs so that they can issue tax cuts to wealthy funders of the Republican Party and other corporate interests. So that's the big picture, is strip and starve people who need these services so that then tax cuts can be implemented. On this one, I think that those funds have already been allocated. They will be allocated in the next Congress. And Trump is running directly into the separation of powers.
Maria?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I was thinking that it was your next question, Jim. I know that we're a little bit running short on time, so we're not going to get to everything we wanted to ask Steve. But one thing I do want to ask is, Steve Rohde, given the conservative radical changes pending in the role of the federal government in the nation's education system, in broad strokes, are there ways in which a student or a teacher experiencing what they perceive as a violation of their civil rights, how will they still be able to use federal or state civil rights laws to bring court cases to seek relief?
Yeah, the one thing Trump cannot do, and he doesn't even appear to be trying to do this yet, is dismantle the entire civil rights structure that has been built up in the United States. After the Civil War, there was an effort during Reconstruction to push back at Jim Crow laws, at segregation. Those were dismantled by the resistance of the South and even by a compliant Supreme Court at the time. We then moved through the civil rights revolution of the 1950s and 60s and on down to today. Fortunately, although it has hardly been complete, we have built a federal structure of anti-discrimination laws that are in place. And so much of what Trump is doing is tilting against those laws. And I think I think that they will hold up. I think there is bipartisan support for basic anti-discrimination laws. I think when we hear the stories of individuals who've been discriminated against as a result of these policies, that's going to be meaningful in the public square as well as in terms of the court system. So I think he will be barking up the wrong tree. And fortunately, many of those laws will unearth the discriminatory nature of many of his policies, because his policies are often written as if they are neutral, but they clearly are going after people of color, marginalized communities, women, the disabled, and other groups, and LGBTQ community. And we've built that structure, and to dismantle it is itself an act of discrimination.
Yeah, you know, the other thing, not surprisingly perhaps, but some of Trump's stated policies with respect to all this are contradictory, are they not? I mean, I'm thinking of the fact that he, on the one hand, wants to get rid of the Department of Education and believes that the federal government should have a greatly reduced role in education. But he nevertheless wants the federal government to dictate curriculum. So on the one hand, he wants the federal government out of it when it comes to money, of course. As you say, he wants to cut taxes for the rich and all that. But by goodness, he's going to keep the federal government's nose in it when it comes to the curriculum. Is that legal? Can he do that? Or is that simply a sign of where he's coming from politically?
No, I think it's both. I think it is a political strategy, but I think it runs up against the legal issues we've been talking about. He really wants to establish the Department of MAGA education, and he wants to have 50 departments of MAGA education in each state, and then one with what's left of the Department of MAGA education at the federal level. This reminds me of what he tried to do with the help of the Supreme Court on abortion. He wanted to eliminate the federal protection for abortion and pass it on to the individual states, which is now causing great havoc. And I think that's what's behind this notion. You eliminate the program, the structure, the money behind the Department of Education at the federal level. You claim to be turning it back to the states. Then you will have the ugly kinds of local battles that we had in the Jim Crow era, when there was discrimination in small towns and state legislatures. So that's, I think, what he's after in this. And I think we're just going to have to go toe-to-toe against him.
All right. You know, I sadly, we haven't really spent any time at all asking our audience to respect the fact that we get no federal money, we don't take corporate underwriting. We haven't spent any time at all doing that. And I fear we must leave at least some minutes at the end of the show to do that. So I wonder if we can jump ahead and just ask you really the final question. You alluded to it earlier. Lawsuits are great. You're feeling more optimistic about it than some people have expressed. And I think you've made a good case for that. But you say lawsuits aren't enough, by which I know you well enough. I think as an activist, you're talking about the street actions we're already beginning to see more and more of are also essential if we're going to win the day.
I am. I think there are five areas real quickly that people need to focus on and put their attention on. We've talked about the courts. That's going to go on at the federal and the state level. There is Congress, as weak and spineless as they have been. I believe certain statutes can be passed. It'll be tough with 60 votes in the Senate to get positive legislation to limit Trump. But I believe carefully construed statutes may be passed in Congress. The third element is the states. We've got a lot of organizing. We have sanctuary cities. We have California legislature pushing back through state legislation to protect many of the interests we're talking about. We can reverse what Trump is trying to do by making our states, where we have some clout, into the protectors of DEI and comprehensive American teaching and the like. Fourthly, we have elections. There are special elections this year. There are midterm elections next year. And those are very important. And we can have a huge impact if we took back the House and the Senate. And then finally, as you so well said, Jim, there's activism. I was so proud of people this last Monday on President's Day, being out in the street, in local towns and counties in the big cities. So we've got to do that. There's an impact on the courts. There's an impact on our elected officials to see people in the streets. The generation that Jim and I grew up in, and the younger generation that Maria grew up in, knows the power of mass mobilization and demonstration. It's reinforcing to the people who participate in it. They walk shoulder and shoulder with their allies in this fight. They are lifted up and heartened by it. And then through the news media and the expansion of the coverage of these protests, it tells you that this president, and let's not forget, when you count all the votes, including the third party candidates, a minority of voters voted for Trump. He has no mandate. It's one of the slimmest margins in presidential history. When we know that, when we know the power of the people, and my beloved Constitution, with some of its flaws, begins, we the people. And I think that's what we can never lose sight of.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you so much. I think we are just going to have to now quickly say thank you again for making this and making it so clear to people. Steve Rohde, we appreciate it. Steve writes in a number of online publications. We'll have Steve back periodically during this period of time, and we can perhaps then talk more about how you can follow him more closely. But for now, good afternoon, and thank you, Steve. Let's get to talk money. Let's talk support. For $150, everybody has their favorite premiums. Maria collects every cup and T-shirt or something that was ever put out by Pacifica. But for $150, you can get this hours and hours from our archives of speeches from the Black Panther. This is Black History Month, folks, even though Trump's going to get rid of things like Black History Month. It still is here at KPFK. You can get hours and hours of Black Party, Black Panther Party, Malcolm X's speeches, Cornel West's speeches, Dick Gregory, you name it. The list goes on and on and on. Hours and hours of this great historical speeches. In many cases, people who appeared right here on KPFK from these famous men and women who were inspirational in the civil rights movement. We encourage you to do that. Maybe you got less money. If you got less money, what can you do? What do we say thank you to people who aren't making that kind of money, so they want to send in $100 or $50? How do we say thank you to those folks, Maria?
Yes, well, there are so many ways can look. I mean, first of all, just by being part of it, just by clicking send, just by getting your thank you donation receipt, that's the best part of it, because luckily KPFK is not federally funded. And I say luckily because I think any media, independent media or otherwise, is so vulnerable right now, including all of their staff. Here at KPFK, it's mostly volunteers. There is power in volunteerism. That's why we keep speaking the truth here. We're not beholden to the federal funds. Please give. There is always great premium thank you gifts on the website, kpfk.org.
Absolutely. Maria and I are not paid. None of the, there's a couple of staff people here who have the shows that go on every day for hours. The rest of us are not paid. The staff itself is woefully underpaid, but they love it here, so they work here. I'm going to certainly pledge again to get one of these gifts I've been talking about. Maria always does, and so forth and so on. But we want you to do that. We want you to do that because we need it if we're going to continue to do and be the kind of radio station that we are. As I've said it, I suppose people are getting sick of me saying it. When you contribute to KPFK, you're contributing to the entire progressive movement for social and economic change here in Los Angeles. Why? Because what other radio station has on the leaders and the activists and the organizers from those wonderful movements to tell you about what they're doing, to tell you about their next demonstration, their next meeting, who you should lobby, who you should write to in Congress or in City Hall to get the progressive agenda passed. So when you give to us, you're giving to the whole progressive movement. And that's wonderful. So you're getting a wonderful radio station in and of itself. You're contributing to the movement when you do that progressive change. You're getting two for the, you're getting bang, extra bang for your buck, I guess the way I would put it, because we would hope that just this radio station, to say nothing of the thank you gifts, to say nothing of the premium thank you gifts. If you go to the website, kpfk.org, as Maria suggested, you'll find lots of ways, lots of albums of music that are hard to find anywhere else, books, you name it. So Maria, what else could we say to folks to make them understand just how badly we really want them now to make a call in these last few minutes of the show?
We are getting that it's time to wrap, but yes, please do give. It's our obligation, it's our duty, it's our passion to spread the airwaves, and we need to spread truth. So please do give.
All right. Well, then, friends, you can make these calls and go to the website, as I'm saying to you. thank you so much for listening today. My friends, stay healthy, stay active. We'll be back with you next week. Listen to that theme song and make sure you continue to stand up for your rights. Now it's more important than ever, my friends. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know.
Support comes.